This episode of IPv6 Buzz is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Start or grow your IT career with online IT training from IT Pro TV, and we have a special offer for IPv6 Buzz listeners. A 7-day free trial and then save 30% off all plans. Visit itpro.tv/buzz for a 7-day free trial and 30% off all plans. Use promo code BUZZ at checkout.
Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffeen and Scott Hoag. And we wanted to let our audience know about sponsorship because that's available for the podcast. And if your company has an IPv6 supported product or set of technologies, we really want to hear about it and you should come on and sponsor the show. So if you're interested, you can go to packetpushers.net/sponsorship. You can get all the details and we look forward to having you on the podcast at some point in the future here. And today we're going to be talking about IPv6 and RFCs and all the goodness that happens, sort of around the RFC landscape. And that's with our guest, Russ White, who, if you don't know Russ, well, shame on you. You probably should by now, but and Russ is currently over with Juniper. And with that, hey, Russ, welcome to the show. Really, really delighted to have you on.
Oh, thanks. First time on IPv6 Buzz. Not first time on a packet pushers channel, of course, but first time on IPv6 Buzz. Yeah, I'm feeling the weight of the 128 bits on my shoulders. I don't know.
Just try to feel the buzz instead.
You should be drinking instead. Don't take the weight of the world. Well, hey, I mean, probably out of all the guests that we've had on, with maybe the exception of Fred Baker, you had the most experience on the RFC and sort of the whole everything to do with the ITF, and we wanted to be able to sort of talk through a little bit about maybe IPv6 sort of journey through the ITF a little bit, but then also how the RFCs and other things sort of inform how protocols work and how we think about this sort of stuff, and. The great way to talk about it is recently RFC 8200 came out. And for those in the audience that don't know, this is sort of like a general, like roll-up RFC is sort of how I think about it, but at least in my head, but I know Russ probably has the more formal definitions for how all this stuff works. And so I wanted, maybe you can start there and sort of explain to us why this sort of stuff is done in the RFCs, because the older RFCs that explain all of IPv6 are still out there, right? They're still all there at the original RFCs, but then the ITF sort of gathered together all of the pertinent stuff and put it together in a single RFC to sort of, push it out the gate and say IPv6 is sort of done and baked, right? Yeah. At least that's my impression.
Yeah, well, done and baked to some degree, yeah. I mean, I think the big thing with 8200 is it's actually an internet standard now, whereas IPv6 before was not an internet standard. And so people get really baffled by that. They're like, IPv6 has been around for 20 years. How can it not be an internet standard? But to understand this, you have to understand kind of the formal language of the ITF. So, if you go way, way back in the old days, IBM used to publish these papers, and they would publish them in different colors depending on how far along the paper was in the editing process or how close it was to being done. And so the reason we have white papers today is because they had blue papers and red papers and green papers, and they would actually print them on different kinds of colors of paper to let you know as the reader where things were. Well, the ITF has sort of the same concept. So things can be standard track, but they aren't necessarily standards. They are just RFCs that are, candidates or whatever you want to call them, that are going through the system. So that this is what's happened here is that 8200 has actually become an internet protocol standard. It's not just an RFC that people are messing with any longer. That doesn't mean it's not used more. It just means that the ITF community feels like there's enough experience or thinks there's enough experience. Boy, my philosophy professor would kill me. I use the feel word way too much. I was used to say.
You can do that here.
No. He used to say, I don't care how you feel. I want to know what you think. So, anyway.
That works just as well in engineering, I think.
Yeah, it does.
The rest of the response is, I think I feel like.
Yeah, I think I feel like. That's exactly right. Anyway, so this is a state where the ITF community now thinks that this is baked enough that it's ready for general release, like anyone can use it. So it's kind of, it's beyond just being, it doesn't mean people shouldn't have used it before.
Right.
You know,
it's sort of that last, it's stepped across the threshold. It's blessed. You should have no fear. This is something that should be, you know, readily used and be part of the general internet overall. Right. In terms right. of sort of philosophy.
Correct.
And I think that's an important point because, like you said, many people are really confused. They're like, yeah, it's been 20 plus years for, you know, it's like, what's going on? Why in the world would you need something like 8200 to sort of, you know, do that? But it's exactly that point, is to put the stamp on it and say like, yeah, this is, you know, this is as finished as you're going to get for this portion. Doesn't mean there's not going to be more innovation that happens, but this is the standard now. So, you know, be prepared. This is something you should be prepared to utilize and sort of move, right. use to move forward. And it also helps the industry move forward, you know, overall in terms of the adoption thing.
Right. So. And the other thing is that this also kind of means that there won't be a ton of massive changes in this any longer.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point too. It's baked. It's done. Right. So that's a big deal, is that now coders can go code this and implementers can implement this, and you don't have to worry so much that things are going to be changing rapidly or dramatically, as the case right. might be.
Yeah, we're not going to, you know, 64 bits and then switching it up to 96 bits and then changing all of that around there. But
is there some risk there, though? I mean, just based on how enterprises have been so slow to adopt IPv6 mm-hmm. and the actual deployment footprint of it is relatively small. So it's one thing to say, oh, we have this RFC that is now fully baked because we're confident that the protocol is going to work according to the spec and the standard. But I don't know. When I think about like how many vendors go out of their way to solve like corner cases for IPv6. Meanwhile, some of the basic functionality is still behaving very strangely in an operational environment. So, you know, it's like we've been telling folks for years, like, go ahead and deploy. You know, you're going to find that most everything works. The stuff that doesn't work, you have, you know, a long runway to sort of fix and figure out. But I think that's why we're having the discussion about what does it really mean that it's a full standard now in terms of, you know, we can talk about that sort of from a more abstract level, but in terms of if I'm an enterprise administrator or an enterprise, you know, IT executive, what is my takeaway from the discussion about it? So now you're telling me IPv6 is ready? I thought you were saying it was ready before.
Well, it was ready before. It just wasn't as ready as it is now.
Perfect. That's a perfect answer.
Is that how you feel about it? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you're always at more risk deploying things that are not at this standard state, mm-hmm. at this maturity level. I mean, these maturity levels, by the way, if you're very concerned or interested, I think they're covered in 6410. If you want to know the actual maturity levels that you can get into. And there's really only two on standards track that I know of, which is just that there are standards track and internet standard, proposed standard and internet standard. So before this, IPv6 would have been considered, when it was in pure draft state, before it would have been accepted as a working group item, and before it was going through any sort of review or last call, it would be considered a standards track. And then it would become a proposed standard when the working group and the ISG agree to it and say, this is good. And then it becomes an internet standard once the experience in the field has become strong enough to say that we really don't think much is going to be changing here. This is mm-hmm. kind of bait. We've tested it and we think it's good.
Okay. So you brought up a couple things there. I want to unpack one of them is you brought up this comment about a working group. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how maybe a little bit of the structure around the ITF and how that sort of maybe you start in one area in a working group and where the ball is being passed maybe as a, in terms of how that RFC sort of moves along or what happens with it. Cause I think that's, you know, I'll be honest. I never even knew which working group you were supposed to submit something under one way versus the other, except for maybe where you got support. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. And part of it's picking a friendly judge too, by the way, it's picking your venue. Who's mm-hmm. the working group co-chair and whether or not they like you. Oh, anyway.
Or at least like your idea.
Yeah, exactly. So documents usually start as individual contributions, but they start with an intent, whether they're standards track, experimental, or informational, one of the three. Now, things can move from informational to standards track over time. That's pretty unusual, but it does happen. So things generally start as individual contributions and aimed at a particular working group, not necessarily always. So for instance, if you're proposing new work that has just never been done before in the ITF, you might, if you're in the routing area, you might go to the routing area working group, you might present it there. And then the routing area working group, the AD sitting there listening to it, the area director might say, hey, this is really good work. And the community might say, this is really good work. And we don't really have any place to put this, to do this. So we'll create a new working group. I mean, that's a possibility. Although it wouldn't start as a working group, it started as a BOF. And then the BOF has to gain enough interest to become a working group. So let's say that you presented at some working group and you're presenting it for a couple of years or whatever. A desktop flood is a good example in LSR. It was originally in the ISIS working group before it was merged with OSPF and became LSR. And there are several others that you could talk about. But what happens is that once the working group, once you get to the point where you feel comfortable that you've socialized it with a working group and people are going to agree that the work is good, then it will be proposed as a working group document. And at that point, the working group has said, we're going to accept this work. We're going to take this on. That doesn't mean that it's ever going to become a standard or anything like that. It just means it moves from individual contribution to a working group item. So the working group is now interested in taking the work on. Now, in some working groups, that means that the individual authors lose the document and it becomes edited by, it starts getting edited by a proposed editor from the working group, whatever. The working group chairs will pick an editor or build a design team or something around it. So anyway, so that's the beginning of the process. So once you get to the working group, now tell me if I'm going too long here, Ed, because this is a long process.
No, I get it. And it's I think it's worthwhile to understand about what IPv6 actually went through.
Right. So it becomes a working group document. And then over time, the working group edits it and does stuff and makes modifications. And then at some point, the working group co-chairs will say, and the authors will say, we think this is ready for a last call. We think this is ready to move to the next step. Now, what typically happens before that even occurs is there are things called directorates, which are because the area directors cannot review every document that lives in their purview or outside of their purview, there will be a directorate review. So the area director before the last call in the working group can say, I would like to have the area directorate for security, please review this document. And there'll be some security expert who reviewed V6. And there'll be some other, there'll be a group of experts that review it. And they'll be from all the different areas. So like I'm on the routing area directorate. So I get called to do reviews of documents in the security area that impact OSPF or ISIS or BGP or whatever they are. And they'll just say, well, some security area group has determined that they want to do this in BGP. What do you think as a routing expert? Like, is this the right way to do it? Whatever. So there'll be a directorate review. It'll go to working group last call. Working group last call, the working group itself will decide whether or not to push it to the IESG. Once it gets to the IESG, it gets IESG reviewed, which is all the area directors, the Internet Engineering Steering Group. So the ISG will then do a telechat on it, which is open to the public. Anybody can attend the telechat and listen. And then they will make a decision whether to push the document forward and what status to place it under. Then it will typically, in the ISG review, go back to the directorates to be reviewed again in a last call review. Then once it goes through all of that, then it'll go for an IETF level last call. And at the IETF level last call, anyone in the IETF can make comments on the document and say, no, stop, or you need to change this or whatever it is. So once it's done all of that, then it will go through the review of the RFC editor's queue and they'll edit it. And along the way, by the way, all of this is going on. The IAB, the Internet Architecture Board, is overwatching all of this process and trying to figure out whether or not this document that you're proposing through this process fits the overall architecture of the internet. And they're also liaising with other outside groups. Like, for instance, if you talk about running HTTP over QUIC, well, in that case, you're actually impacting W3C. So there's an IAB liaison to the W3C to make sure that whatever the quick people are doing and HTTP people are doing, it's not going to impact HTML in some way. And the same thing happens with the IEEE and with the ITU and with all these other standards groups. There's a ton of other standard groups, and there's these liaisons that run between them to make sure that any standard that's going on is not impacting something that one of those other standards bodies is working on. There are also liaisons,
or at least adversely affecting, right? If it doesn't have any, you know,
perfect right effects,
then it's
right.
It's fine, right. So
right. But there might just be adverse, right? It might be that ITU is working on changes to ISIS, and so is the ITF.
Ah, so it's to prevent collisions of same process, same.
Yes, exactly.
Or something at odds, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, or maybe IEEE is working on Ethernet, and we're playing with IPv6, right, in the ITF. Mm-hmm. And so there could be just things that need to fit together in APIs and stuff like that that need to happen. So yeah, so after all of that, then it becomes a proposed standard. It would never move directly to an internet standard. Or it would move into experimental state or individual contribution state. Those are pretty much permanent states until they go historical. Then after a few years of it being used, someone in the working group will say, well, you know, we've been using this for 4 or 5 years as a proposed standard. So, you know, that's fine. So let's move forward and just make it into an internet standard. So this process is actually described in RFC 2026, how it becomes an internet standard. It's got to be initiated. It's got to be reviewed by the IESG. It's got to be reviewed by the IAB. All of this stuff as well. It all happens all over again. And it has to be a proposed standard for at least 6 months. And then it can move directly into an internet standard. Most of the time, it's more like 2 or 3 years to get that done. And by the way, along the way, there are other requirements like routing area. You have to have at least two independent implementations that interoperate and can be shown to interoperate before you can even become a standards track. So there are other things there as well. Transport has to have at least one, I think. But in the case of IPv6 to go standards, you would have to have, you know, way more than one interoperable thing. So that's kind of the process. It's long and drawn out. And why is it drawn out, right?
And a little convoluted too. I mean, it's not obvious for those on the outside who don't do this on a regular basis. And you're looking at it and it's like, yeah, that took an insane amount of time for, you know, IPv6 to become a standard.
Well, you know, if you back up, we're not an open source world. Well, we are an open source world in some degree, right? Mm-hmm. But vendors are actually embedding these protocol stacks in their hardware. And it's very hard to upgrade that hardware once it's deployed. So you want it to be right. And that's
probably why that's a reason that the vendors are so heavily represented in working groups typically, right? Because I'm thinking as a listener, I'm not sure if the listeners are aware of like who the folks are that show up and attend working group meetings and do the contributions. And
yeah.
So it's mostly a lot of vendor representation.
Yep, it is.
But not exclusively.
But not exclusively. And I try to change that as often as I can. If you work for an operator, you should get involved in the ITF. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it is vendors. And by and large, it is because that's who's implementing the stuff. But, you know, things have changed since the ITF first designed this process. That software tends to be more malleable, but that's not necessarily true on the IoT side, right? When you deploy a home router, it's deployed. Nobody's updating that thing.
Yeah, it's going to stay that way for a long, long time.
Yeah. And so you want your protocols to be right? You want them to be correct when you deploy them. So, yeah, I mean, the process is long, but it's long for a reason. And so, yeah, that's kind of why it takes a long time.
Let's pause this 128-bit address space chatter to share a 30% discount offer with you from IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV offers technical training, and training matters in IT where change is the norm. A recent MIT study found that IT occupations have grown by 19.5% between 2004 and 2019, and that is more than 8 times the growth rate than for other jobs over the past decade. While the earnings growth for those with college degrees have somewhat flattened since 2000, earnings have actually grown significantly for individuals working in IT. So hey, if you're in IT, you have picked the right career. It's never too late to move up the ladder, and IT Pro TV has you covered. From CompTIA and Cisco to EC Council and Microsoft, more than 4,000 hours of on-demand training in their library. Engaging hosts present the information in a talk show format, and they're live every day, and shows go studio to web in 24 hours. Courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role, and you can stream IT Pro TV's courses really any way you want, live and then on demand, and you can do it from anywhere in the world using Chromecast, Roku, Apple TV, your PC, or iOS or Android apps. Learn IT, pass your certs, and make a career leap forward or land that new job you've had your eye on with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/buzz for a 7-day free trial and 30% off all plans. Use promo code buzz at checkout. That's itpro.tv/buzz and use promo code buzz at checkout to try it free for 7 days and save 30% off all plans. And one more time, that's itpro.tv/buzz and use promo code buzz at checkout. And now back to your regularly scheduled IPv6 goodness.
I guess maybe the next question is, this doesn't necessarily mean that V6 won't have changes that occur for it in the future or other innovation, just because it's a standard now. It doesn't preclude the fact that it could have other things that actually go on with that, things around, you know, whatever DHCP V6 PD and how we want to see that. Right. And maybe even operator principles, because that's one of the other things that has always confused me around the ITF is, right, you know, best practice, and some of the publishings that go on that sort of talk about like, hey, these are the best practices you should follow. So this is informational, right? And how that fits in. And like, there's all these different sorts of documents that you'll see get produced versus like a protocol standard document, right?
Yeah. So the basic format of the protocol probably will not change from this point forward. The TLVs that are in place are the TLVs in place. You might add more, right, but you won't remove anything for exactly the most part.
Right. Okay.
Would you have adjacent protocols like DHCP6 could make? Yeah.
Yeah.
Could make, yeah, you know, changes. There are other things that can change, but the base protocol itself is pretty much done. Now, if DHCP6 V6 makes it into internet standard, it'll be in the same situation. There won't be any changes to it. Not real. There'll be minor stuff, but not big ones.
And I think that's important. I mean, it's for folks to realize it doesn't necessarily mean that things won't change down the line. And there are a bunch of innovations that are sort of still, still in discussion, SRv6 and others.
SRM6 and that whole argument over SRv6 and SRM6 and stuff like that.
Maybe that's a whole show in and with it. around what's going on. I mean, Scott, Tom, and I were all talking about, just MPLS and what's, V6 and MPLS related issues and LDP and it's just like, it just seems like it's in this weird state right now, right? In terms of like, where do the vendors want to go? Where does the industry want to go? Like, how is all that stuff all going to play together? How do you get from where you're at to where you want to be?
Yeah. Well, we're at that stage where we haven't actually deployed a lot of it. So we're still learning, right?
Right.
So a lot of stuff is whiteboard in theory, but.
I mean, especially around V6 only networks, right? I mean, there's just not enough deployment of V6 only networks to let people know what is the right way to sort of tackle all of that, I think, is one of the points, right? And I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon, because just given the widespread, there's enough service providers who are starting to look at it more seriously in that area, I think.
So. I mean, if I were an enterprise, I would be looking at my data center fabric, unless I were going cloud. But if you own your own data center, I would be looking at running a V6 only data center fabric right now. That would be a place I would start, because I'm already running an overlay anyway, and the V4 is already, I can just run V4 in the overlay. So why not just run V6 only in the underlay? It would give me experience with V6. It's pretty safe place to do it, because I don't actually have hosts necessarily talking V6 if my overlay is V4 or V4 capable. So it's kind of a nice place to mess with things.
Yeah, and we need that from enterprise data centers to help mature like the addressing practice, because there's so much that's possible with V6 and that's just not really being taken advantage of, just in terms of having the space and not having to worry about overlapping addresses.
Yeah. I mean, if you're running a known delay overlay anyway, and you're running virtual segments, ESIs or whatever they are, depending on how your overlay runs, then you should be going to your vendor and saying, I really want a V6 underlay. That's what I want to do, because it's kind of low risk in many ways. I'm not impacting my applications if my vendors are supporting me correctly. So it's, I don't have to rewrite applications or anything. I just run a V6 underlay. It gives me experience with V6, deploying it, doing everything else. See, I say that. I don't know if the vendor I work for would completely support that right now, but that's... I don't think a lot of VVPN implementations today support a V6 underlay. So that's the problem you would run into.
Right. Yeah. That's correct. And a lot of it has to do with like the software control plane side for what they need to do in order to, get for many of them, like VXLAN extensions and get all of that working in the right way. But I think those can be easy incremental wins for many of the companies that are doing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I were an enterprise operator today, that's where I would be pushing my vendor. I wouldn't be pushing my vendor in my WAN necessarily, because that's pretty risky, to deploy something like V6 unless I'm running dual stack. But a data center underlay, why not? Yeah, push your vendor to get it done.
Right. And most folks, for most enterprise data centers, the size of the fabric they're running is relatively
small.
Constrained, right? It's smaller versus like if you're a cloud provider. It's a totally different discussion, right? So I think maybe we put context around that too, is of saying like, hey, if you're that, you've got a couple of data centers and you need to be able to build fabric and you're running hundreds to thousands of compute nodes, this is definitely something you can tackle and it's within the realm for you pretty easily.
And if you can't do it, you ought to go back to your vendors and ask why, right?
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Because that's a definite, ask. That's a very defined, well-defined, well put together ask that you could do to help deploy V6 in your network.
Show up to your vendor waving around 8200 saying, this is an internet standard, damn it.
You think that's going to work? and people from your vendor actually wrote this. Yes.
Put people in a corner.
I think all you'll end up with is the person who participates in the ITF in that case will be taken out behind the woodshed.
It's interesting because I think that one of the things the ITF lacks is really that sort of feedback loop from operators, right? The operator experience around what they're doing with an enterprise versus maybe service provider, cloud scale, manufacturers, folks like that. I mean, maybe you can riff off a little bit.
I'm serious. If you're an operator, if you operate a network, there is no reason you couldn't get involved in the ITF. I get so frustrated that all I deal with is vendors in the ITF. There's just so much more going on and just helping the community and giving your experience and feedback to the people who are developing these protocols. All right, let's be honest. Most of these guys in the ITF are coders, and that's not bad. They're brilliant. They're very good, but they don't operate networks, and they never have. And so there's just a bit of context missing a lot of times that thankfully I have operated networks, so I try to give as much context as I can, but I tend to operate networks in the hyperscale space and stuff like that, not in the enterprise space any longer. So again, just having more input from people who like the whole DHCP V6 argument, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Slack DHCP V6 for...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the protocol purists, Slack is awesome. But I can easily say where...
Yeah, for the operator, especially if you're trying to match your operational roles between what you already have in V4 today, which is super important because you don't want to have to change all your runbooks and how you operate overnight just to accommodate the fact that the protocol that you want has some stubborn folks refusing to adopt.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
An option for you that really from an operator basis makes a tremendous amount of sense. It's just...
Yeah.
And it becomes frustrating because, especially for those of us that are trying to help and around the storyline of saying like, yeah, you know, V6 is something you can deploy, but by the way, you have to learn this whole new nuanced method. It doesn't match what your operational roles are that you do today. And sorry to tell you, but you know, yes, you have more options, but we're gonna pigeonhole you because of the fact that, you know, we don't have all the options on the table for us because not everyone's supporting
it. It's exactly. It is. Yeah. I mean, and there are arguments like this on a regular basis. Network address translation, port address translation comes up all the time. Mm-hmm. Different forms of security. There was someone who stood up at the mic once and said in a meeting about network security that access lists are not security. And, you know, these kinds of things where they're brilliant people, but they're not in reality all the time. They just don't live in the world that an operator lives in. And so protocol security is awesome, but sometime or another, you've got to meet reality. And having more people in the ITF who deal with it on a day-to-day basis would be really, really good. And
it's one of those things, right? That the operators are responsible for producing a cake that someone can eat at the end.
But I mean, larger, particularly larger enterprises, you know, I don't even like the word enterprise anyway, but it is as it is. But, you know, larger operators who are not transit and not hyperscale, they don't live on their network.
Right. Because there are certain enterprises that operate at transit scale because of the relationship of their business.
But, or have bigger networks than some of the hyperscalers.
Right. But the reality is that, you know, that's for specific purposes as opposed to anything else. I think that's the thing that's strange. I mean, a classic enterprise example is probably more in the Fortune category for the mass majority of folks in terms of what I think of in that way. And then, you know, there's commercial or territory or whatever they, you know, whatever select thing. There's all sorts of different namings that people give for things that are lower down the totem pole. But I think many of them operator-wise though run into the same set of problems, right? I think that's common regardless of once you get past a certain size, you start running into the same operator problems over and over again.
Yeah.
At least that's been my experience.
But sometimes your business is different and you think of things that other people don't think of because you're in a different kind of business. And
your
perspective is...
Yeah, if you're in resale and actually running stores and you have, you know, whatever, 10,000 locations, you're dealing with totally different sets of problems than someone who's got like, you know, 20 distribution warehouses or something, right? So there's a different sets of problems, problem space for sure. Well, yeah. I mean, let's talk about V6 from the aspect of where things are at currently in the ITF, because I know you're tracking and keeping track of a bunch of that. And Scott actually posted in here, you know, around, because you want to talk a little bit around some of the stuff that's going on currently. I mean, what's your current outlook around V6 in terms of, you know, ITF and what's happening and what's going on?
So I think the most interesting, or some of the interesting work going on in V6 today is around SRM6, SRV6, trying to figure out how to do traffic engineering better. There is some interesting work going on in telemetry that is kind of in the more experimental phase, more in the this might be stuff that might be interesting phase that I think we need to start figuring out. Telemetry is very problematic though, because there are privacy and other issues you've got to deal with that I don't really know how to deal with ultimately. There are some movements towards V6 only data centers, fabrics, which we've talked about, which are interesting. Scott put in about Rift and how Rift uses neighbor discovery and other things around neighbor discovery to build a data center tree or to build a topology of the data center.
Mm-hmm. And maybe for those that don't know what the Rift...
Routing and fat trees. It's an invention of Tony P, who's actually a good friend of mine. But the idea is to invent a totally new routing protocol just for very, very large scale data center fabrics. Mm-hmm. Partially because I don't know, BGP is not really the right thing for a data center fabric. I'm going to get hate mail now, but that's okay. I don't really.
the guy that just finished learning how to use BGP in his data center is like, what?
that's exactly right.
Especially since he just deployed it with Juniper gear to do EVPN.
Wow. Yes, exactly. And so, yeah. So, I don't know. V6 is an underlay BGP as an underlay is not really ideal to me. There are a lot of reasons for that, but that's another entire show. Honestly, that's like, oh my goodness. That's like a 3-hour show the next time you want to do one. Yeah. But yeah. So, and there are some things around BGP and V6 that are problematic right now. The spec for BGP using link local is very strange. It's very strangely written, and everyone has unfortunately implemented it a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very familiar with this. So yeah, this is one of the structural difficulties. I mean, this manifests itself in all sorts of weird ways where some vendors try to work around this, where they're actually like, yeah, that's great. We have the link local information in there, but we're actually still going to use the next hop as a global unicast address.
Yep.
And there was some strangeness that happened with some certain virtualization software and other things that were, you know, caused some interesting issues in terms of how that works. And then there's all sorts of problems about solicited node addresses and duplicate address detection that fall in line with the same sort of structural problem about that too. So
Periodically, I'll send an email to 3 or 4 coders at different companies and say, we need to fix this. And they'll go, yep, we do. And then
it dies.
And it dies because to fix it, someone's got to give in and change their implementation. Mm-hmm. And no one's going to change their implementation. So I don't know how we're ever going to fix it. But yeah. But
well,
so,
yeah, and there's plenty of use cases, never mind these, even the ones that are older RFCs that have been deprecated, like site local. I mean, you look in Windows, site local addresses are still in there for DNS, for unknown name resolver DNSs, right? Still displays and it's still listed in there because, like, went back and talked to the Microsoft team and were like, yeah, we realize that's not supported anymore, but it doesn't hurt anything. We moved it down on the prefix policy table, so it's not preferred at all. That's already, and we're already conforming to RFC 6724. We're not going to remove that just in case someone put a hook that required that thing in there. Like, we don't want to remove the code because it puts too much risk, right? For sort of doing that. So there's risk involved with actually tearing things out and changing things around, right? That I think everyone wants to try and avoid. And that's probably this point, right?
This is what you get when you implement something before it's an internet standard.
Yeah.
Put a gauntlet down. If they just waited until 8200 came out, it would have all worked out. But now they have no excuse.
That's right. That's right.
Go back and fix your stuff.
But Rift is really interesting. Rift is an interesting movement towards more autonomic operation in data center fabrics using V6. Using some of the techniques and stuff that are available in V6 to make that happen, which is a really cool thing. I'm a co-author on Desktop Flood, so I have a different opinion. But no, I really like Rift, actually. I like Rift a lot. But I also like Desktop Flood. I just think it's different. We need to have different solutions, and that's all there is to it. So Tony and I don't argue about this.
Well, maybe describe a little bit about how each one works very, very quickly in a short summary, if you can.
Yeah, yeah. So what Rift does is it acts more like IS to IS or OSPF from the top of rack towards the spine or towards the core, the center of the network. I almost said core, didn't I? See, and data center fabrics don't have cores, so bad habit. Can't use that term. Towards the spine or towards the T0 or the T2 or whatever it is. And so, but on the way out, it treats it like a distance vector protocol. So it's kind of a weird combination of link state and distance vector. So in the spine boxes, you will know every destination and where it's reachable. But on the edge, on your top of racks, you only have a quad zero. And it's maintained through a distance vector mechanism. And you're using, like I said before, you're using IPv6 neighbor discovery and stuff to actually build those adjacencies to some degree and figure out where things are so that you can do this stuff. Now, Distep Flood's just modified ISIS. That's all it is. So because ISIS is its own ether type, which really confuses people.
It doesn't confuse me, but I understand why it would confuse
people. I mean, yeah, people say, well, it must be IP. No, it's not. It's not IP. It's ISIS. Sorry. it runs on top of Ethernet, just like IP does. It's ISIS. So there are some modifications that have been placed into the ISIS flooding mechanisms and adjacency formation and stuff like that, that dramatically improve the performance of ISIS in fat trees, in clo fabrics and butterfly fabrics and stuff like that. So this code is available in some degree or another in FR routing as an open source stack. There's an experimental version of the Distep Flood available in Junos, but you'd have to ask to get it. It's not available publicly or anything. So I don't even know how you would get it. You'd have to email me and ask me, and I have to ask the coder if it's even available in any way, but it is implemented. And we can do demos of it if somebody wants to see it. Rift, there is an implementation that's commercially available in Junos. And then there is actually kind of a trivial implementation, I think, done in Python. I'm not sure that I would want to run that in my network, but it's out there as a second implementation. And then there is an implementation that is available as like a container or a DLL, a loadable module or something, so that you can actually run it. Now, I don't know what, I think it just runs straight on top of Unix, of Linux.
Cool.
So you can run it if you want to with that binary. I don't think that's available as source code. I know that we've been working with Tony from the FR routing community to get it into FR routing, but I don't know where that is or what's going on with that.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That means you could run it in any virtual lab configuration you want to set up or anything else, right?
Yes, right. Yeah. So the Distep Flood stuff is already in FR routing. It's under, you compile ISIS a different way and you end up with a thing called Fabric D. And Fabric D has all the modifications in it. So those are out there, and they're things you can play with and try them in a lab if you want to and see how they operate. And of course, you can always read the drafts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's, before we wrap up, I mean, any sort of final thoughts around sort of V6 and where it's at and where people should be thinking, and, you know, or is it just like, you know, stop wasting your time, get up and do it?
Yeah, stop wasting your time, get up and do it. Find some place in your network where you can deploy it, start deploying it.
Yeah. And it's, just get it done.
Just get it done. And if you have feedback, get in the ITF six-man maintenance or six-man group and, you know, make comments. I was deploying it and I ran into this. What do you think? You know, don't just talk to your vendor. Go back to the six-man working group in the ITF and actually have people learn something about how the deployment's going in the real world. Or present a paper at one of the ITFs or USENIX or something like that. Very, very useful. Yeah. By the way, for those who are interested in Rift and Distep Flood and BGP, there was just an article published in IPJ Internet Protocol Journal that you can look up. You can look up Internet Protocol Journal. The latest edition has an article by Melchior and I on Rift and Distep Flood and BGP.
Awesome. Well, that's great. We'll put the link in the show notes for everyone in order to be able to grab onto that.
If you can find it.
Well, yeah, that's the issue. That's what the internet is for, right? Hopefully it's available on V6 on the internet. Yeah. Too funny. Well, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for the podcast. Thanks to today's guest, Russ White. How can the audience follow you on the internet? I know you're pretty active on a bunch of different areas. So, you know, let's tell everyone how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah, the easiest place to find me is rule11.tech, which is my blog, which I publish the hedge there and history of networking there, which is really, really cool. In fact, you know, there's a couple of shows on history of networking about the history of IPv6, which are really cool. I don't know if you've plugged those here or not before, but those are good.
Yeah.
Other than that, you can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter, but don't DM me on Twitter. I'm just
like, you ignore it all.
Don't at me, bro.
Just find my email address and email me. Just try. It's just so much easier.
Yeah. And Russ participates in a ton of, if you're in any of the networking Slack channels, he's all over a ton of those. So if you want to reach out to him that way too, it's always a great way. And he's been on a ton of Packet Pusher podcasts. So if you want to, you can just type Russ's name in on the Packet Pusher's website and you'll get plenty of shows to listen to with some great content out there. So we really appreciate that. Well, awesome. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz on our podcast on Twitter at IPv6 Buzz. And you can also hit up each one of us on Twitter. You can hit up Tom at IPv6 Tom, Scott's at Scott Hogue, and I'm at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes. You can always listen to us on Spotify too. And if you like the podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break, and all the other great, technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.